Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this time I'm doing just a regular episode where we're talking about an award-winning science fiction or fantasy book. In this case, it's City by Clifford Simak, and my guest is Christine Baker from Hugo History, another podcast akin to what I do. So, Christine, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, and I always love it when another project pops up that I can be like, yes, subscribe from the beginning, and get to kind of go back through these as well. So tell my listeners about yourself.
I am a historian. Like, I have a PhD in history, and I am also a bit of a sci-fi fantasy nerd, but my nerddom was very focused on, honestly, stuff published in about the last 25 years. I read sci-fi and fantasy as a kid. I'm almost 50 now. And I bounced off, honestly, some Heinlein and some other things like that when I was a teenager. And then I didn't really revisit the genre until about 25 years ago. And I think because I am a historian, I have this like completist need to like understand the genre. And so I have decided as my project for myself that I wanted to go back and read all of the Hugo winners as just one way of looking at the chronology, the development of science fiction and fantasy.
Nice. Now, you're a real pro because you talked right through your cat walking straight across your setup.
She doesn't usually do that. That's actually unusual. But yeah, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to lean back, let her go through. Yep. So yeah, I just decided to do this podcast. I knew there were other podcasts out there Seth's podcast. Like, I also love Hugo Girl.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, it was a way to keep me on task in terms of, you know, actually reading something regularly. I enjoy meeting people, making friends. And so it seemed like a nice way to get to meet people, like to do it, you know, get have a different guest every month. Yeah. And yeah, it's just a fun thing that I'm doing as my
You're getting some great guests as well, and it's really a fun community.
It really is, and people are like really willing to say yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And for me, it's fun to go back through some of these because they're books that I haven't read in several years at least.
Yeah.
And so to hear a different take on one, and you know, sometimes it's like, oh, okay, I like that one a lot better than she did. But it's fine.
Well, and also because like I don't have like the depth or the breadth of knowledge about the genre, and so I'll have someone on who knows a lot more about it. They'll be like, have you read this? I'm like, no.
Yep. But I definitely had a lot of that.
But I also feel myself developing at least some of that as I go further through. And that's fun too. And that was sort of why I wanted to do this.
Yeah. And I think doing it in order too, you get to see the genre progress.
Yes.
But the way I did it randomly, it was a little harder to latch onto that.
Yeah. And somebody, I think in your Discord asked me why I was doing it in order. And part of it is like, I'm a historian. That's just how I do things chronologically. So yeah, it just, you know, I had read a couple randomly along the way, like, oh, I'm going to go back and read Ringworld or something. And then I was like, nah, I got to like do this in a way that I can see like systematically and be able to think about like the historical context of what was happening when these were written, like what were they reacting to and stuff like that. That's really what makes it interesting. Well, they're interesting on their own most of the time, but that is something that adds interest for me.
Yeah. For the record, it's not my Discord. I'm just living in it.
Oh.
It's, you know, Matthias is the boss there.
So. Oh, I did not realize. Okay.
I'm just an evangelist for it.
Oh.
So I'm a recent convert and I still have the zeal.
Oh, amazing. So, okay, cool. Yeah. I literally thought it was yours.
Nope. just when I play around
in it. Nice,
so
nice.
It's a lot of fun.
You know, I've only been on it for about a week. It's a lovely community.
Yeah, it is. All right. Let's talk a little bit about City. I don't know if I know that you usually give a little bit of a kind of a bio of the author. And I think if people want to hear that, they'll hear it in your forthcoming Waystation episode.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, I can talk just a tiny bit about it.
Sure. Yeah, go for it.
So C-Mac is someone who is really known for writing like pastoral science fiction. That a lot of his books are sort of set in like more rural areas. He was, you know, he is a guy who is from rural Wisconsin. He was born in 1904. He was married to the same woman for more than 50 years. He worked as a journalist. So he actually lived most of his life in Minneapolis. He worked for the Minneapolis Star. And yeah, he started writing, you know, science fiction, and I think he was first published by Hugo Gernsback and then eventually ended up having a lot of things published in Astounding. And yeah, you know, the his book, Here Gather the Stars, or also known as Waystation, did win a Hugo for novel, but this book's City is also known as sort of like one of his best works.
Yeah, this is one that I've been hearing about for a really long time and was wanting to get to. And so when we first connected, I was like, we got to figure out a way to collaborate. And, you know, I thought I could come on yours and do one of the, you know, the early books or something, but it would be me revisiting something where my thoughts are already on the internet about it.
Yeah.
And there are a couple titles I wouldn't have minded revisiting just because I kind of bounced off them a little bit.
Sure.
But then the worry is it's going to happen again. And that wouldn't be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's interesting. I already kind of wish that I could redo a couple of episodes, and I'm only like 10 episodes in.
Yeah. But you mentioned a couple titles, and City was one of them. And I thought, yes, let's do that. It fits in my format because it's an International Fantasy Award winner from 1952. And the International Fantasy Award was eventually sort of turned into the World Fantasy Award. So if you get a copy of the book, it might say winner of the World Fantasy Award just because it's, you know, sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think the first story that the collection, because this is a fix-up novel.
Yes.
Of interconnected short stories. But the first story is called City. And I think it's one of the longer ones.
Yes.
Was also an award winner. I was trying to look it up surreptitiously. I don't know if you did.
Sure. Yeah. I think the short story City got a retro Hugo for 1945 for best novelette.
Yeah. Published in 1944. I just found that.
So. Yeah, 1945.
Yeah, and then for the 1945 Hugo. Retro Hugos, because they're for the next year.
Yes. And I actually decided to read I read this book very early on in my journey because I was reading, my brain. What is the first Hugo?
The Demolished Man.
So I had read The Demolished Man for the very first episode. And for your listeners, if you have not read The Demolished Man, there's like just the weird Freudian sex stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought to myself, I need to read a few more books published this year to understand, like, is this part of just the age or is this its own unique thing? So this was one of the books that I picked out because it was in Jo Walton's, her retrospective on all of the Hugos that she publishes over at Reactor. And she mentioned this being a really great book. And so I picked it up for that reason. And it does not have weird sex stuff in it, which I appreciate. True.
So yeah, maybe we should just talk a little bit about what is this book? So you want to describe it?
Sure. So this book was published as a series of short stories over several years, basically over World War II. And then it was published as a fix-up. And when it was published as a fix-up, they CMAQ added introductions to each of the chapters. And so the book is basically it's set in a world where there are no people, there are no humans, but dogs are the sort of the dominant species. They can talk. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, as intelligent as people. They have technology. They mostly have robots to do things that require thumbs.
Right.
And they basically, you are getting a bunch of dog scholars debating these different short stories, which were basically kept as oral histories. And they are debating how much history they contain versus sort of myth. And they talk about, you know, they talk about people in the stories, and the dog scholars debate, like, we don't know if this is really real or if this is like a fiction that our early dog ancestors made up as like a symbol of their god. And so it's this story of honestly like humans leaving Earth and sort of moving off into other planets and dimensions, and Earth being taken over by dogs and sort of like how that progresses. It's very interestingly done, I think.
It is, yeah. The introductory notes to each story remind me of, you know, like a biblical scholar saying, you know, looking at the fragments of Papias or something. And, you know, and they say things like, you know, this one shows certain doggish origin, you know, because of the use of this language, you know.
It is. Yes, it is amazing. I think that is the thing that really got me, because again, like, I am a historian, so like I am used to reading like analyses of primary sources and stuff. And he just like he nails it. Like, it's just so, like, it's like almost like a little, like, historiographical introduction where they're like, you know, this tale is really difficult for the casual reader, like, that uses a lot of words that you might not be familiar with. Its ideas are, right. like, quite alien. There aren't actually dogs in this story, but, and it, like, will go on to give you, like, different dogs and their theory about what this story means. And I love it.
Yeah. And it's funny when, you know, it'll refer to this respected, you know, scholar, known dog in the past named Rover.
Yes.
You know,
or something. It's like Rover and Tig are like the two really big scholars. It's great.
Yes. But the first intelligent dog, of course, was Nathaniel. So that's, you know, after that point, they started getting regular names.
Yes. Human names. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Where do we go from there? I guess the thing I wanted to say was that the interstitial stories with the notes about them are kind of humorous in the way they're written, right? Because you're reading this as a human talking about, were humans myths or were they real?
Yes. And that is part of what I liked. Because, like, so I am, my area of specialization in history is medieval history, but I also teach a lot of ancient history classes. And you are often teaching things where we have, you know, like, we will have different kinds of primary sources, like archaeological remains and different kinds of artifacts. And we are trying to figure out what it all meant, like, especially if it's about a society that predates writing. And I always tell my students, it's kind of a joke, but, like, if scholars don't understand the thing, they always decide that it has, quote unquote, ritual significance. Because it's like, if we don't get it must be religion. You know?
Yes.
And so I thought that was really funny that they're like, okay, we've got this man thing. And what is that? And, like, we don't really think that existed. And let's figure out how do we, since we think it's clear, there's no evidence of man. We need to come up with an explanation for, like, why our ancestors would have created this figure and what it meant to them. And, like, it just feels so true about the way that we analyze sources in ancient history. Yeah. I thought it was great.
It kind of reminded me of, you know, if you look at TikTok or YouTube shorts, people taking history things, especially religious people, they will find, you know, oh, this is a clear sign of the return of Christ, you know, the war in Iran, you know, or whatever. And they'll take ridiculous AI videos of a land formation that looks like Noah's Ark, you know?
Oh,
and, and I think it's so dumb, but there's enough of it out there that a segment of the population is going to just buy it wholeheartedly and not question it. And over time, you know, some of that stuff could come down and that's what gets recorded.
Oh, man. Yeah. I try and avoid the TikTok myself. I feel like a lot of the things, like the TikToks, those are real ephemeral in terms of, like, what's going to make it into the historical record.
True.
And then maybe I'm a little bit happy about that. So one of the things that happens in one of the stories is that humans have gone to Jupiter and they, you know, Jupiter is would not be an easy planet to live on. And instead of trying to, like, terraform Jupiter or something, they are trying to change humans into something that can live on Jupiter. And so they have this, like, machine, I think they call it, like, a manipulator that turns the humans into, they call them lopers. They don't really describe what it is, but it's basically a being that can live on Jupiter. And this might be a spoiler.
And you have to keep in mind, this is 1940s Jupiter.
Yes.
So, you know, before we knew all that much about the actual nature of it.
Yeah.
Planetary science came along and spoiled a lot of fun.
It really did. And this is a bit of a spoiler for the story, but basically, like, they keep sending people out as these lopers and they keep not returning. And so they're concerned that they're dying. And so eventually the person in charge of the project is like, I can't send people out to do this on their own. And so he has himself and his dog transformed into these lopers. And what they learn is that the reason that nobody is coming back is that it is so awesome to be a loper.
Yeah.
Like, they just have this incredible brain connection. Like, you completely understand all of your companions. You're, like, not tied down by, like, I don't know, like, physical reality. and it's just like, you can just, like, run around and, like, they come to a waterfall and it sounds like music and it's amazing. And so eventually this guy comes back and there's this concern about telling the world about what it's like to be a loper, because then every human is just going to want to do that. It's going to be an extinction event for humanity. And I thought this was an interesting point, but like, I in a million years do not think that every single human would choose to become a loper, no matter how good you said it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm not sure I agree. I mean, not every single human.
Yeah, because like in the book, it's almost all of them. There's just like a very tiny human community left in Geneva.
In Geneva, yeah.
But basically, almost everyone does decide to do this. And that was that was something that I found a little bit strange. And, you know, some of it might come from the fact that, again, he is publishing this during World War II, like during this really horrible time that it's like, well, of course, if we had this like paradise where it was amazing to be a human, or sorry, it was amazing to just be, and all you had to do was leave your humanity behind, that would be great. But yeah, I didn't quite.
Well, and equally, it would be nice, and this is kind of jumping from that theme onto another one,
sure.
is if somebody came along, a philosophy came along that made people stop killing each other and you know, kind of united humanity a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. So there's this philosophy that they almost describe like people catching it like it's a virus. I thought like more than just a philosophy, but yeah, this idea of how to understand other people, to not just like see their perspective, but to be able to completely feel it. Like it almost feels like a precursor to Grok from Stranger in a Strange Land. And it then, once you completely understand another person or being, like you're obviously not ever going to hurt them. And so this leads to the end of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, sad to say, that didn't sound that realistic to me either. Not that like I want to judge.
No.
Like science fiction by its realism, but I was like one of those points where I was like, I am not sure. Well, and
it's a nice idea that a philosophy could come around and fix us.
And fix, yeah, exactly. That
but I think if you look at the history of what religions have done, and I'm a religious person, it's not a good track record.
Yes, yeah. That idea is like, even if you think you have one idea that is like super clear, that means like, you know what I mean? Like, just think about, you know, the Bible. Thou shalt not kill. Humans are really good at coming up with loopholes. You know?
Yes.
Like, oh, well, I shouldn't kill, like, these people, but I can kill those people. And, like, the thing about violence I thought was interesting because I couldn't tell if C-Mac was – I couldn't tell exactly what he was trying to argue there, because once the dogs really embrace nonviolence – which also to me makes them like dogs. It just, dogs without any kind of like violence seemed weird to me, because dogs are, I have a dog. I love dogs, but like they are not, anyway, they just seem like they like to like, you know, they like to grapple. They like to fight. It just seems like completely weird that they would not do that at all. But
yeah, they're not going to chase squirrels anymore. I'm pretty sure they
are. Well, you could chase them. You just can't catch them and kill them.
Right. And they still were doing that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But he seems to be implying that once you reach a point where everyone understands each other and no one is violent, then like those societies can no longer progress. Like there were a couple of different points where he seemed to be implying that like you needed like the friction, the conflict,
the striving
to be able to like get ahead. And so I wasn't sure what he wanted the reader to conclude from that. And again, he's writing during World War II. So he had lived through World War I as a kid, and now he is living through World War II, and he's looking around, and I can see him wanting to hypothesize a future society where we have figured out how to not be violent. But I was just a little surprised at these, at maybe this idea that like we need the violence to kind of, again, to like push us towards progress or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can help with what his point was there.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure if you had noticed anything that made you think anything about that. Because I was like, does he like the dog society? Is that good?
Yeah, because I mean, it gets a little mixed up, because it's not just, you know, once you have no killing, then every population of animal is overproducing, right?
Yes.
They don't have the balances.
Yes.
And so that becomes a plot point at some point as well.
It does, yeah.
And, you know, the philosophy stuff is interesting, because, of course, we don't get any soliloquies from Juwayne, you know, the guy who's propounding this philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it's a sad story because he's on Mars, and it's probably a good idea to mention that there are humans on other planets.
Yes.
But on Earth, they're starting to dwindle,
yes.
Move out of the cities and kind of separate. It reminded me, did you read Service Model by Andrei Tchaikovsky?
Yes. Yeah. A bunch of this reminded me of Tchaikovsky, different Tchaikovskys.
Yeah. And Jenkins reminded me of Uncharles from that book.
Yeah.
And there's this guy on Mars who has this philosophy that he's working on. He's on the verge of a breakthrough and believes that this philosophy will move humanity forward 100,000 years in 2 generations. Unfortunately, he falls ill and needs emergency surgery from somebody in the Webster family. And that's another thing to mention is that the main human point of view characters are all from this family. And unfortunately, the Websters have gotten to the point where they're so insular that they never leave their homes. And it's a kind of agoraphobia that's just, he can't get over it.
Yeah. Like, and the Webster in question, he had actually traveled to Mars. He had like worked on Mars,
yeah.
But then he comes home and he can't convince himself to leave. That seems like a theme that we see in a lot of CMAC's work. This, not necessarily the agoraphobia, but this desire to like not be like in cities or population centers.
Yeah,
there's a lot
home.
Of yeah. anxiety about that kind of mm-hmm. thing.
The tragic thing I thought there was it seemed like Webster had just was stealing himself to, okay, I can do this. And then he finds out that Jenkins, his valet robot, had gone out and said, no, you can all leave. He's not going.
Yes. Like that. Yeah. Jenkins had made this decision for him because Jenkins knew him. And that this is something
he's probably right.
Yeah. And this is something that he regretted. And like sort of generations on, it was known that like this, you know, this Webster had cost humanity this possible breakthrough.
Yeah. So Juwayne dies and the philosophy is incomplete.
Incomplete.
And so there's humans, the small group of humans that, you know, most of them in Geneva, there's usually somebody at the Webster house until a certain point where there is not any longer. And then there are the mutant humans as well, who I always pictured Walton Goggins from Fallout when I pictured the Joe, who's this, the mutant humans are loners, right? They don't really have community.
Yeah, we only really hear about Joe, so I don't even know how many there are.
Right. We're given to understand from Jenkins that there is a community of them, sort of, but they're all kind of doing their own things.
Yeah.
But it turns out he was wrong about that as well.
Sure.
Because they up and left as well.
Yeah. Well, so that's one of the other things about the book that's sort of interesting is that you have mutant humans and then also mutant robots. I mean, he doesn't call them mutant robots.
I guess
they call them wild robots.
Yeah.
So, you have this Webster family that lives in this house. And we basically meet one of the early Websters when, like, cities are falling apart. Because I love this part that with the invention of planes, everybody just has their family airplane. Like, you would have a family car. So, like, you don't have to live in a city.
Atomic helicopters. Yeah.
Yeah. You can just, like, fly wherever you want to. And then they've also figured out ways to grow everything, like, hydroponically. So, like, nobody really grows stuff, like, in the ground. So, people just live wherever they want to. And so, cities are dying. And it's sort of like this one guy who really likes his sort of like his house, his place that he lived, this, you know, this Webster that creates this original community where he basically teaches the dogs to talk. Like there's also like surgeries involved. So like their voice box, like there's some waving at the fact that we know that dogs don't have the anatomy to form words. But one of the Websters teaches the dogs to talk, to like keep him company.
Yeah, I wasn't totally sure if it was just a companionship thing or just the idea of uplifting dogs sounded great to him.
Sure.
And the idea of passing things on to them because humans were kind of on the wane. But yeah, his modifications breed true, right? And so I couldn't make out if all dogs had to have those special contact lenses so that their eyes could, you know, so they could read.
Yeah.
They could see in 2 dimensions.
It felt like in the beginning, they needed to have like these interventions, but then over time, they were like, they grew in some way, and they were passed down. I don't know that part. Yeah. I mean, like you know, this is not in any way hard sci-fi, so he's not really explaining any of the tech.
No, definitely
he
not.
He tells you enough to kind of, like, make it seem, I don't even know if plausible is the right word, enough that you can be like, all right, we'll go along with this.
Yeah. One of the stories that sets up a lot of the rest of the book is the third story, Census, where there's a guy, Grant, who's going around interviewing people and interviewing dogs as well. He interviews the dog Nathaniel, who that's one of the ones where they say Nathaniel was a real person, you know, the historical Nathaniel, right? There's probably treatises on it. Mm-hmm. And he encounters Joe, who at first I thought was a robot.
Yes.
Because it seemed to be very long lived. Mm-hmm. But, no, he's just a mutant, and he had helped with the perfection of the interstellar rocket.
Yes.
He had looked at somebody's design and said, here's the problem.
Yeah. So Joe the mutant had basically given, like, the spark that solved the problem of this interstellar rocket.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Grant has the Juane philosophy, the incomplete Juane philosophy with him.
Which I also think is completely weird.
Is it a book?
Is it the only copy?
It's a spiral-bound notebook.
He seems concerned when it gets stolen.
No, they did. They had atomic-powered helicopters, but no electronic media storage.
Yes, just not even photocopiers, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And he reads it and says, oh, yep, he's close, but it wouldn't have worked anyway.
Yes.
And then he takes it. And so now it's not available to humans, but then the mutants end up giving it to humans at a time where it kind of screws everything up somehow. And I'm not sure how that worked.
Yeah. They, like, somehow Joe figures out, he, just like with the rocket, he sees, like, where Juane the Martian went wrong with this philosophy of human understanding, and doing a lot of hand waving here. He figures it out and he fixes it and maybe somehow puts this idea in a kaleidoscope that if you look through the kaleidoscope, you automatically, it's like you have this philosophy, like, downloaded into your brain. Like,
I reread that passage trying to make out exactly if that's what he was saying, was that the kaleidoscope was.
That's what I got. Like, so I had notes from the first time I read it, like, you know, about a year ago, and I reread it, and I was looking at my notes, and there were so many question marks in that section. Because I was like, a kaleidoscope is really an excellent, like, symbol of, like, seeing things from different perspectives. But then to be like, no, we're going to actually have it, like, almost implant this new idea in your brain. Like, once you've looked through it, you understand, you grok.
Right.
And I think, concept.
You know, the idea is that then affected people and made them vulnerable to then the preaching about the paradise in Jupiter and got them all to leave en masse, right? Where the Webster character who was trying to suppress the knowledge of Jupiter was essentially saying, you know, don't do this now.
Yeah.
Like, we're humanity is making strides and, you know, we might come out of this okay. It'd be a shame to trade that for an unknown, you know, that's on Jupiter.
Yes. Yeah. He talks about it like it's this extinction event for humans. And I guess the guy who was turned into a loper, like a person who could live on Jupiter.
Fowler.
He eventually returns. So, like, I think that's in like the third story. And then, like, maybe in the fifth story, he comes back and he becomes a human again. And he is meeting with Webster. This Webster is like he is the chairman of a world committee. And Fowler is basically trying to explain to him that all humans need to become lopers because they're going to be really, really happy. But Webster he literally says, like, I don't know what to tell people because I can't tell people that Jupiter is this paradise that will literally be the end of humanity. And, like, at the same time, they're having this celebration to celebrate 125 years since there has been a murder in the solar system.
Right.
So, like, he is looking about how humans are progressing. And, like, he doesn't want them to sort of, like, give up on being humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he talks a little bit there about having, like, a racial heritage and a racial destiny, which I think reads in a slightly different way today.
It does. Yeah.
But I understand there that he is more thinking about how I think one of the themes of C-Mac's work is sort of like, what does it mean to be human in a larger sort of, like, solar system that maybe is made up of aliens and all kinds of things that humans don't understand. That is definitely something you see in Waystation.
Yes.
And so it seems to me like in this way, at least Webster is like, no, we have to stay human. Whereas like nobody in the book ends up really staying who they are. The dogs become really undog-like in their attempt to sort of like avoid all violence. They can't even kill like squirrels and birds. They even have this conversation like, are we allowed to kill fleas? Nobody likes fleas. you know?
Exactly.
And we haven't talked about this yet, but we also end up with an ant civilization.
I was going to mention that about Joe. Yeah. That's something that he starts as well.
Yeah. So Joe, the mutant, had been experimenting with ants to sort of see like they seem to have built this really complex civilization, but like, why have they never developed further? And he has this, he basically does a bunch of stuff and he realizes it's like every time they go and like hibernate over the winter, they forget everything that they've learned. So they always have to start
over. It's a reset. Yeah.
And so he basically creates like a dome that's warm. So like they don't have to hibernate. And so then the ants get really, really smart. And then they also sort of start taking over the world.
That's one of the interesting things. Yeah. It looked very crass as well, because Joe has done this experiment and he's seen that now they have machines, right? You can see like coal fires or something going on under that dome. And then he steps and breaks the dome. And you think, oh, that's terrible. You just destroyed everything in your experiment. But no, what he did was he released them back into the world to take those advancements into the rest of the species.
Yeah. And
again, but you don't realize that until quite a bit later.
Yeah. And that it is the fact that he released them, he like broke the dome open, that made them have to sort of fight to sort of create their, like, you know what I mean? Like, it gave them something to fight against. And
yeah,
so
it gave them
a
new population pressure, right? Or adaptive pressure.
Yeah, it is.
To talk about it in evolutionary terms, right?
Ends up, this is not a happy story. Like, it's not like a soup, you're not like hit in the face with it, but like when you think about where everyone ends up, like nobody ends up in a particularly good place.
Right. I found that throughout I was like, oh, I expected there was going to be a golden age of humans and dogs living together and being able to communicate.
So basically what happens with the dogs is that, again, another Webster descendant, he is living in this human enclave of Geneva, and he decides that humans are too screwed up and that dogs need a chance to like be the dominant species. And he does something to basically close off Geneva and also somehow eliminate all evidence of man, which is how we get to the point where the story is like that the dogs are trying to figure out if man ever existed.
Well, he was writing a comprehensive history.
Oh, yes, of Geneva. Right?
And so then basically he just destroys his own work.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if he gave Jenkins the robot, an order to help suppress this, because he clearly is helping.
Yeah, I think he definitely explained his idea to Jenkins that he needs to like that humans have screwed up and dogs need to have a chance.
And it's funny because he travels from Geneva back to the Webster house and he goes there and he encounters a dog named Ebenezer who wants to jump up in his bed and snuggle, right? Like dogs want to do. And Ebenezer says to him, I like it here. And Webster thinks he's saying in the house. And what he means is on Webster's lap.
Yes.
And I don't know if that, that's the golden age that I want, you know, dogs and humans, right? They're best friends, man's best friend for a reason.
Yeah.
But we don't ever really get that.
No. And like, John is the Webster who we are dealing with in this section of the book. And he basically talks about how like, I think I wrote this down. I think it's a quote that he says that human life is a senseless paradise that, humans want for nothing. They don't have government anymore because like everybody has more than they need. And so who needs to like to have government? Yeah. Like religion has disappeared. The family unit has fallen apart because you don't need like any kind of provider or protector. And you know, John has been working on this history of Geneva, and he's like, no one's ever going to read this because, like, nobody needs to read this. And his, I don't know, a woman that he had a child with, I don't know who it's Sarah is.
His ex of some
kind. Ex of some kind. You know, she's an artist, and she, like, paints all these things, but it's like no one, I guess everyone's just in their, they're just in their own little, like, we don't really get other people, but it's like there's no community. Like, because everybody has everything they need. Like, this part doesn't, this is the part that doesn't hold together for me at all. That this idea that, like, because everyone has everything they need, then they're just just doing one thing on their own and not even talking to other people. Like, it seemed a little bit strange to me.
It didn't seem like there was anything that would inevitably lead to that.
Yeah, exactly. But this, oh man. I mean, this does seem to be a concern in science fiction. I can't think of what books it is, but I've definitely read other books where they are.
Childhood's End, definitely.
Okay, I haven't read that. Where they're playing with this idea of, like, what would it like to be a person if all of our needs were met and we didn't have to, like, work or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there does always seem to be this concern that humans would just become, like, basically you would just, like, sit in front of a TV and just, like, eat and just not ever do anything. Like, sort of like the Wall-E image of humans on those ships. And that has never made sense to me. I feel like when people don't have to, like, you know, people don't have to, like, worry about, like, feeding themselves, I think a lot of people would do really cool stuff. I don't understand this argument that humans would just become completely passive and would do nothing but watch, like, TikTok videos until they, like, melted into their couch. Like, you can watch a lot of TikTok videos and still have other time of the day to, like, do interesting stuff, you know, like,
yeah, if you don't have to be working 45 hours, 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I do get some of the, like, in Childhood's End definitely has this in it. This is an Arthur C. Clarke novel.
Yeah.
Where art kind of starts disappearing. The, you know, the idea of the starving artist, right? A lot of really good art, you know, jazz and the blues, you know, comes out of suffering, right? But, you know, not every kind of art comes out of suffering and striving.
Yeah. And, like, a lot of times I think that, like, there are a lot of artists who could make a lot more art if they didn't have to starve all the time.
Yes.
Like, I guess there's this idea that, again, like, we need the violence or discomfort or the struggle in order to, like, develop. That's something that we're seeing. And so maybe what CMAC is trying to say is, like, he feels like he's caught because he is, as a person, is living through World War II, where he's seeing all this fighting, and he is thinking, what would it be like to live in a society that had completely left violence behind? And he can't convince himself that it would be better. And that's a real bummer.
Yeah.
So a thing that I completely didn't understand about the book that I'm wondering what you thought was, the Cobleys.
Yes. I was just about to move us to talk about those.
Okay.
I feel like there's a little bit of, and I've criticized other books for being cat books because I'm a dog person and I've never connected with cats. Mm-hmm. Could be because I'm allergic.
Sure. But,
I've never seen the utility of them.
I like, for the listener, some of my cats are literally coming over as if to be like, what?
Yes, they're shocked and they're like, wait, but you're friends with this guy?
We are a delight.
Yes, yeah. But here, I wonder if Simak, because he intimates that dogs have always had a form of ESP. Mm-hmm. And there are cute videos that you can see of dogs, you know, waiting at the window, even though, you know, their dog parent has not left work yet.
Yes.
But they will be home shortly.
Yes. Right?
And so the idea is here that dogs have some form of listening that they do, and they're hearing other worlds. They're hearing other dimensions that share space, but not, you know, reality.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's his explanation for dogs barking at absolutely nothing, which my dogs do all the time.
Our dog does too. We say that he's reporting dog crimes.
Okay, I will use that one.
We live on the fifth floor of a building, and, like, he's looking out the window, and we're like, sir, those dogs are allowed to be on the sidewalk five stories below us. And he's like, dog crime!
Yeah.
You should know that.
Well, sometimes I just, I think my dog is barking, and what he's saying is, we're barking now.
We're barking now.
And that's all.
Yeah. Winston has a list of things that are dog crimes, including being a golden retriever. He doesn't like that. He is opposed to the Goldens.
It's a very common crime.
Yeah, he has to bark. It is a very common crime, and he does not like it.
The Cobbley, I do want to talk about that, because I think that, what was that? I can't remember the name of the Webster. I only wrote down Webster instead of the first names.
Sure. Which section? I probably have it written down.
Hobbies, tale number six.
Tale number six.
You know, the one who wants to erase.
That's John.
The existence of humans and allow, okay, John.
Yeah, he's the one writing the history of Geneva as John.
And he starts hearing about the Cobbley worlds and thinking, you know what, the dogs are never going to develop the way they need to with humans in the way. Because if we're here, they're always going to want to be right by our sides.
Yeah.
And so that's, I'm not sure what he learned about the Cobbleys from them.
It is like, so the Cobbleys seem to be other dimensions.
Yes.
I was also just curious about the word, the Cobbleys. Like, I tried to find if it had other references. And I didn't.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to look it up on Urban Dictionary.
Oh, I didn't look it up. I just Googled it, you know, but I didn't see anything specifically. It just wanted me to know about like cobbles, like cobblestone streets. I was like, no, yeah. Cobbleys.
I hope it's not an older, really offensive word.
Oh, no. Well, okay. I mean, I guess that would be a thing to learn.
Yeah.
But
that would go in warnings for 21st century readers if it was.
Absolutely would.
Yeah. And there is some language here. I mean, warnings for 21st century readers. There's one female character in the book.
Yeah, it's a very dude-focused book. I mean, and the one female character in it, like, she's a very advanced, like, science technician secretary.
Yeah.
Like, it's unclear.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's John's ex as well.
Oh, okay.
But like, all the dogs and all the robots are coded as men.
It's true.
Like,
this is not past the Bechdel test, even a little.
No, definitely.
Also, we keep saying, keep talking about man, because that's what the book refers to it as. Like, we're not talking about people or humans. It's man.
Yeah. No inclusive language.
No. I mean, and, you know, like, yeah.
Think back to original Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Where no man has gone before.
Sure, sure. I think with classic sci-fi, I have never super minded the books where women don't appear. It's when women do appear and then are treated in a really sexist, misogynistic way.
Yes.
That's the part that I really bounce off of. But this, I'm like, no, they just weren't ladies. Like, okay, fine. But no, the Cobbleys when I first read the book, I just literally did not understand, because it's not really explained. They just sort of start talking about like hearing voices from another place. Because eventually they start moving into these cobbly dimensions. Is that your understanding of what starts to happen towards the end?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not just the dogs, though. I think it's intimated that the mutants also did that.
Yes. And maybe the ants as well.
Yeah. And so it's like somehow the higher order power that humans kind of missed out on was the ability to travel between dimensions. But it's not a monolithic either, right? Cobbleys just means other dimensions. So a Cobbley comes through in story number seven, and it's nasty, right? It has come into this world and is looking for life to kill.
Yeah.
A world where killing is unknown.
Yeah. And like, again, that part was very confusing to me. Like, are the Cobbleys just another dimension? Is it like, is there an evil force there? Like, I think it made me think of like, the old movie Poltergeist, where like the little girl is like listening into the TV to like hear that. And so it felt very sinister to me. And it seems to be at least a little bit sinister in that, again, one of these Cobbleys comes through and I think kills a wolf character.
Yeah, kills one of the wolves.
But also they want to go to these Cobbley dimensions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is that the ants are taking over, and the dogs realize that, and Jenkins realizes that with the ants industry that they're doing is eventually going to take up all the space in the world, and there will be no space left for the dogs or the other animals. And so then the dogs are looking for a place to go. And there are other dimensions that seem to be life supporting, but mostly empty.
Yeah. Like, and at some point Jenkins gathers up all the Websters that are left and brings them to a different dimension.
It's very close to the same, but not the same.
yes, it's just like, it looks just like our dimension, but like there's a different tree over there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of that stuff, it didn't like, I don't know if I like, cause again, like I've now read it twice and mm-hmm. within a year, so not so far out. And I had notes from the first time, but a lot of that still didn't, it didn't completely hang together for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you know, all the humans are in Geneva, but also the Websters are still around.
Yes.
And I, at first when Peter is using his, he called it a throwing stick, which is a, it's a bow and arrow.
Right? Yes.
This thing that he's invented. I didn't know he was human.
Yeah. I thought he was a dog at first. This is
something that a dog did.
Yeah.
And the book does not really hang a lantern on, you know, and tell you, oh, by the way, this human character, Peter.
Yeah.
It just expects you to remember that, the feral child of one of the Websters, was out in the woods, you know.
Yeah. I didn't even put that together till right now.
Yeah. I realized it today.
Yeah.
That was the same character.
Because John closed off Geneva while his mm-hmm. son was off, like, with
in
some friends, yeah. like, playing at being a hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. And also, like, we don't get a sense of what it means to, like, close off Geneva. Like, what does that mean?
Right.
I also, yeah, I'm not totally like, sure. Again, as a historian, there was a lot, like, I don't know if the dogs would do archaeology, but, like, just because there are no humans around doesn't mean there isn't evidence of humans. Like, how could you obscure all right. evidence of humans? Like, if you are digging, you will come upon, like, bones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the in the introduction to the stories, sometimes it'll talk about how, you know, this is clearly a fantasy because it talks about other worlds, right? Mm. Other planets in the solar system. And the dogs don't have science in the same way that humans do. And the robots have not taught them that.
Yes.
About other planets.
Yes. The role of the robots is also, so we have Jenkins, who is like the robot butler for the Websters, and he is around for the whole book. Like, you know, he is like.
And it's thousands and thousands of like, years for anybody like, who hasn't
at least 10,000 of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't see that many other robots, but we are led to believe that like every dog has like a robot assistant.
Yeah.
To like
to help pick the fleas off.
Pick the fleas off, help them get food, help them do the things that you need thumbs for. But then the ants start infecting the dogs.
Yeah.
With it's like they make robot tiny robot fleas. Ants, fleas that then get on the dogs and like so wait, no, because like they affect the dogs, but they also affect the robots.
They get onto the dogs and then they jump to the robots.
Oh, I see.
Is my impression. I was reading that one today.
Yeah.
And you know, the dog was very offended that someone thought it was a flea. No, it was not a flea, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And then they see it get into one of the robots. And the robots have been receiving the call, right?
Yes.
Where all of a sudden they go off and they help the ants build their structure.
This big building that the ants are doing. But again, like we don't really learn anything about the ants. We just see that they have been uplifted in some way by Joe and they are building. And I don't know if we're supposed to see humanity in this, like humans,
right.
we are building
is this,
without
is this
sense,
communism?
Without meaning. Is this communism?
Is it the Russian bloc? You know, think about the time. You
yeah.
know?
I mean, maybe, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it's a collective structure, right?
Sure. Whereas ants, like the dogs represent like individuality and freedom. Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see that reading. That seems fair to me. But yeah, the robots are just building with no, we don't understand what their goal is. And like eventually, sorry, I don't remember if this is the epilogue or.
It is the epilogue.
Yeah.
Where you're going with that thought.
Yeah. So there's an epilogue to this book that was written in 1972. It was part of a collection right. that was put together for after John Campbell died. And
yeah.
someone wanted C-Mac to write another story in this world. And he was, it does not seem that he actually really wanted to. And he felt very weird about it. But in this story, Jenkins is still around and no one, there are no dogs. There's nothing. And the ants have basically built over, we're led to believe it's like the entire world except for like a 5 mile like sort of radius around the Webster house, which they've left
yes.
as sort of like, you know, out of respect.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to see what the ants are up to and there are no ants there anymore.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that it's telling us that the ants also went to Cobbly World.
That's my impression. Yeah. That they also had used up everything on Earth and then left.
Yeah. And then Jenkins gets basically Andrew, who was a wild robot, comes in a spaceship to see Jenkins and is like,
right.
There are other worlds out there and there's life on them and we have
work to do. Yeah, there's plenty of work to do on other worlds.
Yeah. And again, we get the impression that Jenkins is leaving, but he is very sad about it.
Yeah, he's reluctant to leave, but he eventually does walk out and go into the ship.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a happy ending for him, I guess.
I guess, but it's like the world has been left. Well, I guess, I mean, they talk about mice in the epilogue, that there are all these mice around and they're not smart. They can't talk, but like, I don't know, maybe the mice will take over eventually. It is.
Yeah.
There's the cyclical nature of just, it's like this idea that like violence is bad and no one wants violence, but you also need violence to keep people like progressing and also to limit population numbers.
Right. To maintain balance in populations.
Yeah. And if you don't have that, then every intelligent species eventually basically takes over everything. Except it then seems weird that they just abandon it. Cause like,
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like Clifford C. Mack was, he was maybe a little depressed in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. That could be because like, it's just very somber that everybody advances to a certain level and then they leave. And I can't remember if the final story, I was reading it earlier this evening and I didn't get all the way to the end. And I had previously read it, but
sure.
What's happening still in Geneva? Because John Webster had gone, because his ex had gone and she was going to do a couple hundred years at a time in this perfect dream that she could pick, which being in a dream, you can't wake up from, no matter how nice, sounds awful to me.
Yeah.
If you have any knowledge that you're in a dream.
Yeah.
But he had decided to go there and just be down forever. And I thought, was Simak afraid to have him just blow his brains out or something?
Yeah, it was because so Jenkins goes to Geneva to talk to John, who has been asleep for
10,000 years.
Yes, thousands of years.
Because the ants are taking everything over, and he's going to ask for a solution to that.
Yes, and so John is like, oh yeah, we took some syrup and we put poison in it, and we made it so it was just a little bit amount of poison so that the ants would take the poison back to the nest.
Slow enough acting so that it'd get the queen.
Yeah, but this technology, basically, Jenkins thinks to himself, this requires the knowledge of killing and chemistry, which are neither things that the dogs have expertise in.
Yeah.
And Jenkins doesn't want to tell them about killing. Mm-hmm. And so he just decides he's not going to. And John just goes back to sleep. Like, and again, like, I am left with this really depressing view of humanity that. I mean, I feel like Clifford C. Mack would have hated social media and the internet.
Yeah.
Like, it's just this idea that if you have something that's entertaining enough, you're just going to plug your brain in and you don't need to even person anymore. Like, that you'll be like, oh, I don't need to, like, have friends or a family or a community because I can just watch these videos or, you know, live in this dream state forever. And it's just – so part of what's weird about this for me is that – there is a coziness about C-Mac's style, and this coziness seems so at odds with his conclusion that, like, humanity is, I don't know, like, doesn't know how to be happy. Like, they, like, that they have to kill and destroy in order to, you know, in order to basically remain viable on the planet.
Yeah, to be themselves. And that's why Jenkins took the Webster family away.
Yeah. Right?
Because he realized with the bow and arrow and all that kind of stuff that they were also fascinated with, even while he's trying to teach them how to shift dimensions.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, can we use the bows and arrows now?
Because they become awesome. They act like
And so he's
children.
Like, hey, I'm going to whisk them away so that they don't pollute this world with their killing. But they can go try that on a brand new planet.
Yeah.
Brand new dimension. Yeah, it's funny because I really like the book.
Yes.
And I know this about myself. I'm a very happy person. I'm not prone to depression of any kind, but I love a downer ending in a book. So I don't know what it is about me, but I'm totally okay with a book like The Road.
I really liked this book. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I like is, again, this sort of cozy pastoralism. Even if I don't agree with, like, I live in a city. I love living in a city. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, I very much enjoy urban life. I would mm-hmm. not go and live. I have lived in small towns and in the middle of nowhere. And I really like living in a city. So I don't agree with CMAQ's fear of the city, although I can respect that not everyone wants to live in a city. And again, like, if you think about his message here, it's a very depressing message. Mm-hmm. But also, like, I still found the book just really interesting. You know, positing this, like, okay, dogs have taken over and they're trying to figure out, like, they have these old stories. What do they mean? Where did they come from? How can they analyze this to learn about their own past? And I don't know if these dog scholars are, like, living in a cobbly world. You know, they don't really explain that. You know, like, somewhere we have a giant dog university where they have gone and, you know, they're debating about their own history. I do like the ending is depressing, but there's a little bit of a hopeful note. This idea that Jenkins is going to go off and, you know, that the other wild robot is saying, like, there's work to do, which is mm-hmm. similar to, I think, the way that the kind of like the note that Waystation ends on, that like a new big thing is happening and, you know, there's more work to be done. And I like that, but I'm still it is still a bummer, man.
Yeah. One thing that I liked was the development of language, where at some point the dogs don't refer to humans, even though they remember them as Websters.
Yes,
and I think that is kind of the way things go. You know, it's now the generic name. It's not Band-Aid brand. Yep. It's just a Band-Aid.
Yep. Xerox, Q-tip, mm-hmm. Google.
Yep.
Yeah. No,
that one was quick too.
Yeah, the Google was quick. Yeah. I don't know. So like, I don't know if what it is that I was just not really familiar with this whole like pastoral movement in sort of classic sci-fi. And I don't know if mm-hmm. there's a lot of other authors who do that. Like, again, I think it's a little bit, I don't know if we would call it cozy.
Right.
If it was written today, like it doesn't, you know, like there's not a lot of like big explosions. Again, there's no violence. There's conflict, but it's like there's not a lot of tension in the novel. And I did enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not sort of like, I don't feel like I read a lot of sci-fi that's like this. So maybe a part of it was just that it seemed very different. Cause like, even though mm-hmm. I do enjoy a lot of sort of like cozy fantasy stuff, cozy sci-fi, this had a much different feel to me.
I would say that I started reading this one quite a while ago after we first talked about doing this. Mm. And then I kind of got busy doing other things. And I thought, I'm just going to listen to the audiobook for this one. Mm. So I just went ahead and ripped through the audiobook. But then going back through it to read it in print, it really rewarded that process just because I could see the seeds of future stories in the earlier ones.
Mm.
And so that was really interesting.
I do think it's a book that it benefits from reading more than once. Or perhaps we have given enough background now that maybe. If you read it, that you would see some of these things. And I like that as well. How is the audiobook? Mm. I prefer audio in terms of like my own reading, but when I read for the podcast, I always do it. I don't do audio.
Whenever I can, I do both.
Oh, sure.
It's a decent audiobook. It's not amazing, but it's serviceable.
Yeah.
There are some that are just bad, and so I wouldn't recommend it. Wouldn't recommend those, but this one's fine.
Oh, okay. That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, like, I like this book, but I also see why, like, it was Waystation that won
a
Hugo.
Yeah.
Although, again, this was published, this would have been probably a book they were considering in the year that The Demolished Man won.
Yes.
And I don't know. The Demolished Man is also, there's just so much weird Freudian psychological stuff in there that comes out in like weird sex stuff that I did not find that a pleasure to read. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting that The Demolished Man and this and another book that came out this year by Theodore Sturgeon, one called More Than Human.
I haven't read that one.
They're all very, very concerned about like mind reading, like telepathy, and this idea that this is a skill that some humans may develop, and how is that going to change society?
Yeah.
Which, like, I don't know if we see quite as much in more contemporary sci-fi. I mean, obviously, sometimes we have like telepathy and stuff in books, but I don't know. Yeah. I think it becomes more of a plot device and less a thing that we're really concerned about.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, John W. Campbell put his thumb on the scale a lot, too, with his editorial stuff where he would be like, yeah, but can you put more ESP in it? You know.
Oh, I didn't realize I didn't realize that Campbell was into that.
I mean, he was really into Scientology.
So he
was really into the mind.
Sure. I mean, like, he dabbled in Scientology.
Yeah.
And like, so one of the things that I think is also happening here is that like the 1950s is like when psychology is developing as a field.
Yeah.
Like 1950, 1951 is when like the DSM-1 is published. Like, this is when we are first coming up with sort of like drugs to treat different mental illness. And so like you suddenly have a lot of like psychiatrists around, but there is a lot of quackery.
Oh yeah.
And so
there's a lot of stuff in the DSM that they're
absolutely
subsequently they're like, maybe we don't include that as a mental disorder.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so I think it's interesting that it's clear that we have like sort of authors kind of trying to deal with some of that they're, you know, like how do we analyze the brain through like psychiatry as clearly part of their like science fiction future technology model. Whereas we have figured out a lot of things. I mean, obviously, it's not like we're finished. And science fiction is still often concerned about, you know, human thought and what goes on in our brains and how that can be altered. But I don't know. I always found that – I find that kind of interesting as well, just looking at their perspective on how brains work. Because it's like in the 50s after World War II, that's also when they're – for the very first time, they're realizing about things like PTSD and trauma. This has a long effect. And – you know, we have this character, Jenkins, and he's a robot, but he's also definitely a person. He has feelings and emotions, even though it says at the end of the book that he cannot cry, even though he wants to. And I do not remember at all where I was going with that.
No, just kind of talking about the era that this came out in.
Yeah.
And
yes,
you know,
thank you.
There's a lot of stuff from the 50s where it's all about atomics, right? All atomics are going to solve everything. And you know, you think about Foundation, that's all about you know, atomics and mentalics and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, what are the things that are going to make our lives better in the future? And it's clear that they really, really were hoping telepathy was going to be developed.
Yeah.
Whereas, I don't know. I think mind reading sounds terrifying. I don't think that I want to know that much. Like, I think that, like, oh man, like the, you know, the sort of being able to separate the signal from the noise when it comes to stuff like that.
I think it's tough enough to know your own mind.
Yes. And again, just because you can see what someone's thinking doesn't mean that you understand.
Right. Right.
They were just hoping that there would be some way to, like, you know, I guess avoid war, avoid violence. And he wrote a cozy story about how, nope.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're looking for a book that's a bit dour in places, kind of funny as well, but dour, you know, this is a good one.
So what did you think of the dogs? I did not think that they were all that dog-like.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure how doggy they were. And I think that's a consequence of evolving them. You don't know what the consequences are going to be of that.
Yeah. But I was a little bit, so I don't know if you have read, Tchaikovsky has a series, I think it's called The Dogs of War.
No, I haven't.
I mean, Adrian Tchaikovsky is just, he is so prolific you can't even. Oh, yeah. Right? Hold on, let me look this up.
Are there literal dogs of war in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is called hold on a minute. Yeah, it's a 2017 novel and it's called Dogs of War. Okay. And the thing that, and again, it involves basically like humans are creating like mecha dogs to like fight stuff.
Okay.
but as you might expect from Tchaikovsky and having read things like Children of Time, he takes extremely seriously the question of what a very smart dog would be like. And I think that he does a very, very good job portraying what sort of like what those dogs would be like, what they would want out of their relationships with humans. Whereas this book, it just a little bit just felt like people in dog costumes.
Yes. Yeah, it kind of did.
Yeah.
I might have to pick that one up. I've got a bunch of Audible credits that I need to use. So
I do. I recommend it. It's the start of it is I definitely was slightly dubious at the start. It's part of a series where he kind of explores. Anyways, it's good. Recommend. I like everything that Tchaikovsky writes. It's a problem because he writes too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a wrap on City. Sure. So, Christine, thank you so much for doing this. And thank you for picking an interesting book that I'd wanted to get to for a long time.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's fun. And it's fun to like sort of like see the people like I am walking in your footsteps, your Hugo podcasting footsteps.
I think you're doing a tremendous job.
Oh, so thanks.
I look forward to the beginning of every month. I wish you were doing it faster, but I can't criticize you because I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, my job becomes a lot more chill in the summer because, again, I teach classes. So I'm definitely going to be doing some like interesting other episodes.
Oh, fun.
Because there are some people that I want to have on who want to come on, but like, I already have the Hugo Award winner scheduled for the rest of the year. So we're gonna see. There might be a couple of other episodes, and I'll have to decide kind of how I'm gonna do that, and they may be just dropped fairly randomly.
So bonus episodes, awesome.
Exactly, bonus episodes, but not requiring subscription. Just bonus for bonus's sake.
Excellent. Well, on that note, where do people find you?
You can find the podcast Hugo History at wherever podcasts are found, Spotify, iTunes, all of those good places. You can find me on Blue Sky. My handle is a little bit weird. It is at klaxoncoms.com because that is my website. I do like some freelance writing and my partner and I were joking around that sometimes I feel like a human klaxon. So we went with Klaxon Comms. Anyways, so klaxoncoms.com on Blue Sky, where I'm pretty active. I like talking to people. I am also on the Discord that is not Seth's Discord, but tell them about the Discord because that is a nice place to talk books.
It is called the Nebulugo Book Club blog. Book Club Discord. So if you want to, just reach out to me. I'll get you a link because everybody over there wants more people to talk to.
I was actually going to ask you that because I was telling somebody about it tonight. A friend of mine who has been like, he's in my choir and we realized that we were kindred spirits when we were at an activity and somebody said something about like a Hugo and we both at the same time were like, let me check my spreadsheet. And we're like, you have a spreadsheet? I have a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
So he would, I'm allowed to invite people to the Discord?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to invite him. He'll be very excited.
Yep. As long as you're nice, you know, and everybody over there seems great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I wasn't sure what the rules were. Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Same. Yeah. This was an absolute blast. It's great to talk to you. And, you know, if you ever need somebody for one of those bonus episodes, let me know.
Oh
and,
yeah. I would love to sort of start thinking about that. Yeah. Cause I'm hoping to have, I've been talking to Premi Muhammad about coming on.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Cause she was saying that she's trying to promote her book that's coming out in October with Hills. And I was like, are you willing to talk about an old sci-fi book too? And so she wants to talk about Little Big, which was a Hugo nominee, but didn't win from like the 80s. Mm-hmm. So, and then, yeah.
I really enjoy doing that kind of stuff where you talk about books that didn't quite win and so maybe need a signal boost.
A little bit more attention. And and that's why I thought this was kind of fun because obviously it won other awards, but
Yes.
But I also when I started this, I had never heard of Clifford C. Mack. Like I knew Heinlein, I know Asimov and, I know a bunch of sci-fi people's names, but I'd never ever heard of C. Mack. And like, honestly, I find his stuff to be really delightful.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, Christine, I'm sure we'll figure out a way to interact more down the line, but it was a pleasure.
I hope so.
All right, bye now. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Christine. If you have not checked it out yet, check out Hugo History. If you're somebody like me who just enjoys going back and listening to discussions about these books, I really enjoy it just because it informs my memory of the books, and it's interesting to see ones that I really love that somebody else bounced off of, or vice versa. So definitely check that out. Like I said, if you want to join the book club, the Nebulugo Book Club Discord, not blog, let me know and I'll get you a link to it. It's really a fun community for people who are interested in reading through the Hugos or Nebulas or both. On another topic, you will by now have noticed that the Hugo shortlist is out and Hugo's There is not on it this year. I will not say that I'm not disappointed. I kind of had a feeling. I've been watching the numbers the last few years and I just felt like the support was a little bit on the wane. And, you know, I'm thrilled for the people who are still on the ballot. I wish them all the best of luck. I know who I'll be voting for. You probably know who I'll be voting for as well. But I wanted to say to the people who have reached out to me and expressed, you know, condolences, I really appreciate it. It's nice to have friends out there who are looking out for my mental health. You don't need to worry about me. I'm not the kind of person to let something like this get me down. I have no plans on stopping the podcast. So if you want to nominate me next year, then we'll see about getting back onto the shortlist. But I'm going to keep my chin up. But again, I really do appreciate all the people who reached out to me. That's very sweet. Of course, if you want to help raise the profile of the podcast, you can do all the usual things, share on social media and leave a review in wherever you listen to the podcast. I do see comments come in on Spotify periodically, and it's always kind of fun to interact with people there. I don't usually do it on the podcast. I just do it on the platform, wherever somebody leaves a comment or a review. I have a couple people who comment on the posts on the website, so you can do that as well. And, you know, if you're somebody out there who has been listening for a long time and you've never reached out, send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. And I think you'll find me an affable sort. As always, I need guests. You know, I do have a few more months kind of planned out at this point, but if you have an idea for a podcast, if you want to do a foundational fantasy one, just reach out to me in the various ways. If you want to do just a regular episode like this one was, you can reach out as well. I do still have a couple of people I have to get back to get something scheduled. You know, rest assured, I'm still doing my thing here, still enjoying doing it. And, you know, I don't do it just because it gets me on the shortlist. That's just a fun side benefit. So we'll see you about next year. And good luck to everybody who is on the shortlist this year. All right. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. I appreciate it. Bye now. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.